Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
As I mentioned on Sunday, Jeff and I came in here on Friday and talked 5 hours of theology in response to a sermon preached by a pastor in Murfreesboro. And because you're actually here tonight, even though I sent the files to Jeff today and they're not quite on the website yet, although by the time the folks on the web get to hear this, it'll actually be up there. But for you folks that are actually in the room, if you can't wait, there it is, the five MP3 files, and you can copy it tonight on your way out and listen to it. I think you'll be very pleased with it. I, for one, was very pleased with Jeff Young. You'll listen to it and you'll go, that was kind of the Jeff Young show with his guest, Jim. And so it was, yeah, it's really, really good. So I'll leave that here and you guys can copy it. You'll recognize the voice of the young lady that introduces us. Yes.
Jeff's got a great recording voice, too.
I've known Jeff for several years now, and he's got all the stuff. He's got the tools. He's got the intellect. He knows the scripture. I just knew that the level of agreement we had, that it was going to be like playing doubles tennis, you know, when you're playing with a partner that you really trust because you know he's got your back all the time. So I thought when I got here that Jeff was just going to have my back, but it turned out that Jeff just like flew out into the lead and I just went, well, you go. Just go on then, you know.
So we know how to get him out there.
Yeah, so you'll enjoy it. And meanwhile, then, folks have been asking me, so I'll just say this publicly. It'll go up on my blog as soon as the messages hit the website. The message we're responding to is from New Vision Baptist Church in Murfreesboro. You can go on the web and do a Google search on New Vision Baptist Church up there on Thompson Lane. The pastor's name is Brady Cooper. And during the question and answer section, he has his father-in-law up there with him. If you go to their site, go to the messages that you can listen to or download, and you're looking for the one from Wednesday, January 10th. It's his Romans series that he's doing on Wednesday nights, but on that particular one, on the January 10th one, he actually even notes that that's the predestination study that starts out with the statement, we're going to talk about a dangerous subject tonight. Predestination is a dangerous subject. But Jeff and I really used it as a template for all Arminian anti-Calvinist arguments. So we really kind of took what he said and used it as the large template for, you know, the vast majority of folks out there arguing against us, because they all argue the same way. They all go to the same text. They all make the same assumptions, that same repetition of the same wrong ideas. So, good. So listen to that. Also, Robin and I went by today and booked the room at the Smyrna Town Center, where we'll be having our dinner on the Saturday evening of the homecoming weekend. So if you're out there listening to me and haven't told me yet that you're coming, please do. And if you've written to me and told me that you're coming, tell me how many people you're bringing. I've had a couple people say, I plan to be there, but I don't know if it's just you or you and some other people, because we have to get a reasonable head count in order to let them know how many meals to make and all that kind of stuff. So, okay, Genesis 15 is where we are. Genesis 15. You know, you're right that last Wednesday was Valentine's Day, and tonight is Ash Wednesday. So we only meet on those holidays that fall on a Wednesday, if we can. Ash Wednesday, the beginning of the weeping over the death of Tammuz. That's not how they see it, but that's actually the history and background of it. So it's always interesting to watch. I have friends that I work with who used to show up at the studio with a little bit of ash on their forehead. And I would always ask them, do you know why you have ash on your forehead? And they never know. They just know that when they go to their church, that's what somebody does to them. So. Exactly. I tell them, it's because Mardi Gras is over. That's why you have ash on your forehead. And they buy that like it's a real explanation. They actually go, oh, that would be it.
Why was the ash on the head in relation to Tammuz?
It's the beginning of the 40 days of the weeping over the death of Tammuz, which is actually restricted in the book of Jeremiah. They will tell you that it has to do with, that it's tied in with Jesus' 40 days of temptation in the wilderness.
Right.
And actually, Ash Wednesday is part of the whole, well, the same thing Mardi Gras comes from. It's all part of that pagan bacchanalia thing that has nothing to do with the history of Christianity or the church. But because those two dates fall on the same date, they got combined, and next thing you know, we're putting pagan ashes on our head to mark Lent. Which Lent, even the word Lent comes from, Lenten, the Lenten period, comes from lengthen, the lengthening of the days. It's a spring feast. Easter is a spring feast. The shortest days are behind us. The days are getting longer. And so now the lengthen is starting, which became the Lenten period. And now it's called Lent in the church. And people are okay with that. They go, well, it's 40 days of Lent. And so I'm going to give up something for Lent. And then they give up something they don't like anyway. I'm giving up broccoli for Lent. And how much broccoli do you normally eat? None, but I've given it up for Jesus. And the Lenten period, I try to explain to them, do you understand that when you say, I'm giving up something for Jesus because it's Lent, and so I have ash on my head, that what you're saying is, I'm keeping a pagan ritual and giving up something for Jesus simply because the days got longer. Do you understand how absurd this all sounds when you put it together? And yet, boy, that's the way religious ritual works. People love tradition. And of course, that whole weeping over Tammuz thing is strictly forbidden in Jeremiah. So they'll say that it has to do with Jesus' 40 days of temptation in the wilderness. And that's how they tie it in with Jesus. Except that his 40-day temptation was at the beginning of his ministry, right after his baptism, and has nothing to do with the 40 days leading up to his crucifixion. They just kind of went and found a 40 somewhere and said, oh, that's it. Jesus, 40, wilderness, that's what we're doing. But I grew up in Detroit with a whole lot of Catholic friends. And boy, when Lent came around, you know, they were all walking around bragging about what they'd given up. And the really, really righteous ones would give up, like, I've given up chocolate chip cookies, something they actually liked. But it was amazing how many would go, you know, I've given up fish sticks. You'd go, oh, I'll bet God is so impressed right now. He is up there going, look at that good saint giving up fish sticks, you know.
Well, I think that would be pretty handy. I've decided to give up, during that period of time, parental leniency. With the lengthening of the days, I'll have more daylight time with which to be less lenient.
I'm with you. More time to be less lenient. All right, we are actually in Genesis 15, and we got as far as verse 6 last week, that he believed the Lord, and the Lord counted it to him for righteousness. We'll start in verse 1 for context. If Jeff were here, he would say, because context is king, but we'll let that go. You'll get that joke. I guarantee, by the way, after you listen to the theology talk, every time I say the word context, you'll be forced to say, because context is king. Anyway, you'll get that. Just listen. Chapter 15, verse 1. After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. And Abram said, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus? And Abram said, behold, to me thou hast given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, this shall not be thine heir, but he that shall come forth out of thine own bowels shall be thine heir. And he brought him forth abroad and said, look now toward heaven and count the stars, and if you be able to number them, he said unto him, so shall thy seed be. And Abram believed the Lord, and the Lord counted it to him for righteousness. And then the conversation continues, verse 7. And he said unto him, I am, this is God continuing to talk, I am the Lord that brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to inherit it. And Abram said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? God does not respond well to why questions. We've seen this all the way through the Bible. You look at the book of Job. By the time God shows up and says, quit you like a man, I will ask of you, I will demand of you, and you will answer me. God says that in response to Job finally hitting the, why, if God was here now, I'd ask him a few things. Why, God? Why? God, when you ask him questions like, God, I'd like to know the answer to the question, how do I know that you're going to keep this promise? God launches into the next roughly 600 years of human history and explains to Abraham everything that's going to happen to his descendants after Abram dies. Because I'm sure when Abram asked the question, he was saying, you know, what sort of guarantee can you give me? Can you give me some sort of emblem, something that'll give me the confidence that I'm actually going to get this? God's answer is, well, since I'm in control of all human history, the way you're going to know it is I'm going to give you an answer so large, so expansive, that you can't see it in your lifetime. It will be those descendants that I actually bring back here that will be the ones to look back on all this and go, hey, this is all exactly like God said it was going to be. He said, I'm going to prove it, not just you, I'm going to prove it to your next several generations. And so he says to him, I am the Lord that brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to inherit it. And he said, Lord, how shall I know that I shall inherit it? And he said unto him, take me a heifer of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. This is the beginning of the formation of a covenant. This idea of covenant is something you're going to see through the rest of the Old Testament, and it is God who is going to establish how covenants are made. And a covenant is formed by taking an animal, dividing it in half, and then the two people who form the covenant together walk through the halves of the animal. And the agreement basically is, if either of us doesn't keep up our side of the deal, let it be done to us what was done to this animal. I mean, that's how you strike a bargain right there. I mean, if Shane and I wanted to work out a deal where I was going to, like, buy a truck from him or something, we'd have to go out here in the parking lot and cut an animal in half. And then all the neighbors who were curious about us would say, see, they are into animal sacrifice. And then we would walk through those animals on the agreement that if I ever missed a payment, he has the right to do to me what was done to the animal. I mean, that's how you form a covenant right there. Now, at this moment, God is laying out the elements to establish a binding covenant. And I'm sure Abraham's expectation is that he's going to be in covenant with God. The two of them are going to make a covenant. They're going to go through the animals together. So he says, take these animals, verse 10. He took unto him all these, divided them in the middle, and laid each piece one against the other, with sort of a separation between them they could walk through. And then the birds he did not divide. He just laid them on either side. And when the fowls came down upon the carcasses, Abram drove them away. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. Why do you think God put him to sleep at that moment? I mean, it's dark, it's night. And it doesn't just say Abram fell asleep. Why do you think God knocked him out right then?
Make sure he didn't wake up and jack up any of his covenant all done by God.
I think jack up is the phrase we were looking for right there. I think, yeah.
You know how us.
No, but I agree with you that I think God put him to sleep to make sure he didn't interfere. Don't go through those animals. You lay there and don't get up and don't head toward those animals. I'm going to promise this covenant. I'm going to give you this covenant, but you are not going to be one of the participants in the covenant making. So, very importantly, as I keep saying, the Abrahamic covenant is an unconditional covenant. And it's very important that you understand that, because there are no conditions placed on Abraham. Rather, God says, I'm going to give you a seed, I'm going to give you descendants, like stars, like sand, and I'm going to give you this land, and you're going to have this land eternally, forever, it's yours. And then he doesn't lay any conditions on him. In other words, God is going to make a binding covenant with God, which the writer of Hebrews says, whereby it is impossible for God to lie. So, here's what happens. He said to Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them for 400 years. Now start thinking about what God's saying here. Abram says, how do I know I'm going to get this land? And God says, I'm going to do something so remarkable with your descendants that there'd be no way that they could deny the hand of God in this. So first, I'm going to take your descendants, and I'm going to put them in a place where they're going to serve in bondage for 400 years. What? I thought you loved me and my descendants. All God has said so far is, I chose you. I chose you. I'm the one that brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees. I am working out my will through you. And I am going to take your descendants, whom I have promised this land, and take them into another land where they're going to serve for 400 years. Well, of course, that's the Egyptian captivity. God already ordained the Egyptian captivity of the Israelites before the first of them was born. You get that? Is this the real, real sovereign God we keep talking about? The only Hebrew on the planet, which at this point just means sojourner, somebody without a permanent land to call his own, is this guy Abram. There's nobody else. There are no descendants of Abraham yet. And God says, I'm going to cause 400 years of slavery, bondage, affliction on your descendants because you asked that question. In response to your question, I'm going to do this. Remarkable. Then he says, even more amazing, and that nation whom they shall serve, I'll judge them. Now, wait a minute. Did the Egyptians actually have anything to do with the fact that the Israelites end up being their slaves? Well, yes, after their flesh, after their will, after Pharaoh's own decision-making, yes. See, the whole story, the big panoramic story is there are going to be 12 brothers, and out of those 12 brothers, Joseph is going to be betrayed by his brothers, and Joseph is going to be left in a pit and then sold off into slavery, and then he's going to go work for the governor Potiphar for a while, and then Potiphar's wife is going to accuse him of rape, and then he's going to end up in prison again. And then while he's in prison, he's going to accurately interpret some dreams so that Pharaoh's cupbearer gets back into Pharaoh's court. And Pharaoh then is going to be haunted by bad dreams. And then the cupbearer is going to say, you know, there's a guy in your prison who accurately said that I was going to be restored to my position, and I was. You might want to talk to him. So God plants this dream in Pharaoh's head and gives Joseph the ability to interpret the dream and brings Joseph in front of Pharaoh, and he interprets the dream accurately for him. And Pharaoh says, oh, I had this terrible dream. There were 7 cows that came up out of the Nile, and they were big fat cows. And then I saw 7 more little thin, sorry-looking cows come up, and the thin cows ate the big fat cows. I don't know what it means. What's the dream mean? And Joseph accurately says, there's going to be 7 years of plenty, and then there's going to be 7 years of famine. And he says, well, you seem like a bright guy. What should we do? That's the Jim version of you seem like a bright guy. What should we do? You won't find that exact translation. What should we do? And he says, well, here's what you need to do if I were you, Pharaoh. During the years of plenty, you should store up. And then during the years of famine, you'll have a lot of stuff stored up, and all the people will come to you to get their food. And he says, that's a great idea. You do it. And next thing you know, Joseph becomes second only to Pharaoh. And then eventually, as the famine hits, his brothers, having no food in the land of Canaan, end up coming to Egypt, and they end up in front of their brother, the very one they had sold into bondage and slavery. And Joseph ends up saying to them, once he reveals to them who he is, he says, well, you meant it for evil, what you did. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good to save many people alive. I've quoted that to you often as an example of God's compatibilism, that he uses the evil, wicked ideas and machinations of humans to ultimately accomplish what he chooses to do. He has to bring the descendants of Abraham into Egypt. And then once they're there, Joseph sets them up as kings. And to this day in Egyptian history, as you read about it, you can read about the Hyksos, the shepherd kings, which to this day the Egyptians don't like, because they have that history of the shepherd kings who ruled over them for a while. And then the book of Exodus starts with, there rose up a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. And he sees all these people in his land, and he says, you know, if my enemies ever come after me, these people could side with my enemies, and I'd be even worse off. So he puts them all into slavery, which I'm sure to the generation of Israelites that were there and put into bondage, this seemed horribly unfair. Because that first couple generations lived and died in the bondage in Egypt. Why? Because God said so. This is all God playing out his plan. God is moving people around and whole nations and people groups like checkers just to work out his plan to prove to Abram that this land does belong to him forever. And so then 400 years go by, and surprisingly, this prophecy is known well enough that it gets to Pharaoh, that it's been 400 years, and there's a deliverer coming. And so Pharaoh says, drown all the babies. He thinks he can kill off the deliverer in that generation by drowning all the babies in the Nile. And you know the story. Moses' mother puts him in an ark and sails him right into Pharaoh's house. And he's raised right there in Pharaoh's house. And the book of Exodus says, and 430 years after they had gone into their bondage, they were released. 430 years, they're released. Remarkable. God says, 400 years, four generations, they'll be in there. And then I'll bring them out with a mighty hand. But when I bring them out with a mighty hand, we all know this story. He then drowns the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. And that's after plagues, unbelievable plagues of lice and frogs and hail that burns and darkness that consumes light and the Nile turning to blood and all these plagues, culminating in the death of the firstborn of all Egypt. And before all that happens, God says to Moses, now go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. But oh yeah, he's not going to let you because I'm going to harden his heart. And I'll harden his heart so that he doesn't let you go because I'm going to judge him. Why? Because he said back here he was going to. Now, let me ask you a couple questions then with that big panorama in view. How much choice did Pharaoh have in the whole deal? I mean, was he going anyway to inherit, as he did, he inherited the Israelites as slaves when he came into his rulership. And then he did make it hard on them, and then he did suffer those plagues. And then he did go chase after them, and he was drowned in the Red Sea. God said back here, the nation that they have to serve, I'm going to judge that nation. Does that seem fair that God would judge the nation who he said, okay, the Israelites are going to go serve the Egyptians for 400 years only because I say so. And then after that's over, I'm going to judge the Egyptians for keeping my people in bondage for 400 years. Does that seem fair at all? That's a remarkably sovereign God who at this point is just demonstrating, look, I'm in control of human history. I'm the one who does these things. Now, the answer to the question, did Pharaoh have a choice? Is Pharaoh did exactly what Pharaoh wanted to do. Every step of the way, Pharaoh did exactly what he wanted to do in keeping with his own character and nature and desire. He did everything he wanted to do and yet did exactly what God predetermined he would do. This is that compatibilism that we keep talking about and talking about that you see in the book of Acts, and that Herod and Pontius Pilate and the Jews and the Gentiles were gathered together for to do whatever God's hand had predetermined to be done. So here's God just, I hate to use the term showing off, but here is God demonstrating his absolute sovereignty by saying to Abram, let me tell you what the next several hundred years of history for your people is going to be like. In answer to, how do I know I'm going to get this land? That nation whom they serve, I will judge, and afterward they will come out with a great substance. The last thing God did with the Israelites in Egypt was he told Moses, now go tell them to borrow everything they can get off their neighbors. And they borrow silk and cloth and gold and silver. And the Egyptians are so sick of them, they'll give them anything. They're like, here, take the cattle, take the stuff, just stop the plagues. And then they leave with all the stuff and God drowns their debtors. This is a good plan. This is a plan I wish happened more frequently because I've borrowed money. And it would be nice if my debtors just were suddenly gone.
Although speaking as a banker, I don't think I really want
No, you're not big on that plan? Okay.
I mean, it would be okay.
I didn't mean you. I meant those. I was talking about those evil bankers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then look at verse 15. After he's given him this great, overwhelming view of what's going to happen to his descendants, he says, oh, yeah, and you, the oh, yeah, is not in the text. I added that. That's an interpretive thing I added. Verse 15, and you will go to your fathers in peace, and you will be buried in a good old age. In other words, all this stuff, this is all about me. I'm doing all this, Abram. I'm doing this for my glory. I'm doing this to establish my covenant that I'm making with myself, and you want to know what guarantee you're going to get that you're going to inherit the land? You're going to die. That's what's going to happen to you. But I'm God, and I'm going to do everything I said I'm going to do because I'm God, and I'm going to do it all. But in the fourth generation, now if you think about it, at this moment, we've been seeing lifespans go about 100 years. and he's just equated four generations and 400 years. So a generation at this point is 100 years. In the fourth generation, verse 16, but in the fourth generation, they shall come here again. Now look at the next phrase. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. What? Okay, so the people who are living in the land that I promised you, their iniquity is not quite full yet. That's why I'm not doing this now. So what I'm going to do is, this land is yours, Abram, and your descendants. But I'm going to take your descendants out of this land when there's still only 12 of them. I'm going to take them into Egypt, and I'm going to grow them up over there in Egypt. And all the time that I'm making them a huge people group in Egypt, the Amorites over here are going to be increasing in their sinfulness. And then when that reaches the full, it'll just happen to be the exact same time that I'm ready to bring your people out of Egypt. And so I will bring your people out of Egypt with a strong hand and a lot of wealth, and I'll bring them back to this very land. And then, as we know, in the book of Joshua, starting from Jericho forward, here come the Israelites in like God's battering ram, taking out the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and all the Ites that live in that area, the Canaanites. Israel comes in wiping them all out because finally their sinfulness is at the full. Can you even conceive of any of this? That God says, no, I'm going to take your people group out of here for a while. The land is yours. But they're not going to come back here and possess this land for several hundred more years. Now, it's yours. But you're not going to have it, and the next several generations are not going to have it. And then while I'm growing you up over there in bondage, I'm going to let the Amorites be filling up my wrath. And then I'll use your people to come over here. And while I'm using your people, the Israelites, to drive the Amorites out of the land of Canaan, I will judge the people who held you for the 400 years that you were over here in bondage. Can you even wrap your head around a God that's in that much control? And as I keep saying, a God who can do that can take care of your electric bill. Right? A God who can do that is very aware of your disease. A God who can do that understands your family dynamic. A God who does that knows what your work situation is. Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. A God in this much control of human history is perfectly capable of handling you. You are no big challenge to a God this big. So he says, in the fourth generation, they will come here again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. And it came to pass that when the sun went down, it was dark, and behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp is the way it says it in the King James. What's your translation have there?
A blazing torch.
A blazing torch and
a smoking fire.
So the idea is fire and smoke. You get the picture? And so I'm going to use terminology that's used later in the Bible, a pillar of fire and a pillar of smoke. Any of this sounding familiar? He says that when the sun went down and it was dark, there was a smoke furnace and there was a burning fire lamp that passed between the pieces. So God was making a covenant with himself in the type of a burning lamp and a smoking furnace. Verse 18 makes it very clear. And in that same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. Now, what's Abram doing at this moment?
Sleeping.
He's out. He's knocked out. But God's moving through the animals, and yet it says he made the covenant with Abram. Did Abram pass through the animals?
No.
So if Abram doesn't live up to the covenant, can God do to him what he did to the animals?
No.
No, Abram didn't pass through. The only one that passed through was God. So it's totally, utterly, completely up to God to keep the covenant. Can Abram do anything to annul the covenant? No, it's not his covenant. He didn't do anything. He's asleep. In fact, I will show you how the author of Hebrews deals with that. Hebrews, chapter 6. Let's start at verse 13. For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by nothing greater, God swore by himself. So how secure is that promise?
Very.
Very. And the Hebrews writer says, okay, so now God was going to make a covenant. God is going to swear an oath here. And because normally an oath was sworn on something greater than yourself, God had nothing greater than himself, so he swore on himself. And he said, surely, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply you. And so, after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. At this point, we're talking about Isaac. He obtained the promised child. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end for all strife or disagreement. Look at verse 17. Wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of the promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things, in which it was impossible for God to lie, we might have a strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope that is set before us, which hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which enters into that within the veil, whether the front runner or forerunner is for us entered, even Jesus, made a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So there you go. The writer of Hebrews says that this Abrahamic covenant was an oath that God made with God. And he did it in a way that he made it by two immutable things, therefore it is impossible for God to lie. Therefore, everything God says to Abram is rock solid because it's not based on Abram's ability to keep or prevent it. He can neither add anything to it or subtract anything from it. Abram received it with no conditions whatsoever. You understand that? Turn over to the book of Exodus for a moment. Exodus 13. Because God made a promise to Abram that he was going to take his descendants into a land where they weren't known, that they were going to serve there for 400 years, that he was going to bring them out richer than when they went in and bring them back to that very land. And when he made the promise, he used two types of himself. He used the burning furnace, fire, and he used the smoking lamp. He used smoke. Fire and smoke were the two emblems that established the covenant. Got that? So now in Exodus 13, we've already seen all the plagues. The firstborn have all been killed. And it's time to bring Israel out of Egypt because the time has come. The fullness of the Amorites has been built up. It's time to deliver the Israelites. It's time to punish the Egyptians. And look at the image that shows up, starting in verse 17. It came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war and return to Egypt. But God led the people about through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up harnessed out of the land of Egypt. What do your translations have for harnessed there?
In orderly ranks.
In orderly ranks? Mm-hmm. Okay. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straitly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones away hence with you. Joseph was so sure of the promise that they were heading back to Israel eventually, back to the land of Canaan, the land of promise, that he had made every generation of Israelites agree that when they left, they would take his bones. He was not going to remain there in Egypt. He wanted to be buried in the promised land. And they took their journey from Succoth, and they encamped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. Look at verse 21. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of a cloud to lead them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, to go by day and night. And he did not take away the pillar of the cloud by day nor the fire by night from before the people. And you know, they followed those two emblems for the next 40 years till Joshua led them into the promised land. Now, do you realize what that means? It means that the same two emblems of God that appeared to make the promise showed up to keep the promise. It's bookends. The same two emblems that went through the animals brought the people out and then interfered to accomplish everything God said he was going to do. Bring them out rich and judge their captors. Watch this. Verse 14, and the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pi-Hereroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal-Zephon. Before it shall you encamp by the sea, for Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are entangled in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. Do you realize what God just said? He said, okay, and I have to judge these people. Here's the way we're going to do it. I'm going to set you up. I'm going to put you right up against the edge of the Red Sea so that Pharaoh, when he hears that, will come after you. This had to be a little disconcerting to them. And I will, verse 4, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart. There he goes again. That he shall follow after them, and I will be honored upon Pharaoh. How does he get honor upon Pharaoh there? He's going to drown him. Yeah, kill him and all his army. And God says, I get honor out of that. And upon all his host, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? Oh, I don't know. Maybe it had something to do with all your firstborn dying. Or maybe that whole frog, locust, hail that burns thing. Maybe that had something to do with it. Can you imagine going through that level of plagues and then going, what have I done? I let them go. That's insanity. Why did he go that crazy? God hardened his heart. God's turning this man because the heart of the king is in the hands of God. And like the rivers of water, he turns it wheresoever he wants. I mean, this is God working out his will in the heart of an Egyptian king. So he made ready his chariot, verse 6. And he took his people with him, and he took 600 chosen chariots and all the chariots of Egypt and the captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh the king. How many times have you seen that? And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh the king of Egypt, and he pursued after the children of Israel. Yes, because that's a bad idea. They've got God fighting for them. And the children of Israel went out with a high hand. Richer than when they went in. That's what God promised them. I'm going to bring them out with great wealth. But the Egyptians pursued after them all the horses and the chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army and overtook them encamping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord, and they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you brought us out here to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? So the people of Israel see, you know, this is our demise. We're right up against the sea. There's nowhere to go. Here comes the army. They're going to kill us. And they become sarcastic. Oh, weren't there enough graves in Egypt for all of us? You had to bring us out here to die? Is not this the word that we did tell you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Are these believers at this point, by the way? Any faith going on here? Are they in the midst of God's great deliverance?
Yes.
Yeah. Are they believing in God at all?
No.
Any faith in God's deliverance at this moment? We're on God's side, God's on our side. Remember, by the way, I just mentioned all the plagues. When the plague of darkness hit Egypt, down where the Israelites were, light. When the plague of lice came, didn't bother them. When the firstborn died, none of the firstborn of Israel died. How do they not see the hand of God protecting them in the midst of all this? And then they think that God would bring them out there and put them up against the sea and kill them. So they start complaining. There's no faith here. And yet God is saving them anyway and going to do a miraculous delivering miracle. Why? Because he promised Abraham he would. He already said he would. He already said he was going to do all this. Yes?
And he's bringing honor to himself.
And he's bringing honor to himself.
Showing his power and his might.
Yep. And keeping his own word.
Regardless of the hardness and the rebellion of the Egyptians, as well as the faithlessness of the Israelites.
There's nobody faithful here.
Right.
There's Moses in the middle of it, but there's nobody here looking to God for an answer. And yet he's doing exactly what he told Abram he was going to do. And Moses said unto the people, fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today. For the Egyptians, whom you have seen today, you shall see them again no more forever. And he's right. God wipes them all out. The Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. I think that's the proper reading of it, except he was probably shouting it. There was a large group of people.
Well, the ESV actually says it in a little interesting way. It says, you have only to be silent.
You have only to be silent. God's going to do this. You don't have any part in all this. God's going to do it. And the Lord said unto Moses, wherefore do you cry unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel, that they go forward. What's forward at that point?
Into the water.
Into the Red Sea. So you tell them to go forward. Verse 16. But lift thou up thy rod, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. By the way, the rod there that he's mentioning is actually Aaron's rod, the one that he uses to make the Nile River bloody, the one that he threw down on the ground that became a snake. This is Aaron's rod. This is the same Aaron's rod that later is going to bud a sign of resurrection and then is going to end up in the Ark of the Covenant. So this is an important thing. God is not just arbitrarily saying, hold up your rod. He says, hold up that very rod that I've been doing the miracles through, which rod is later going to speak of resurrection and going to end up being a type of Christ inside the Ark of the Covenant. So this deliverance has a lot of extra typology going on here. Lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. By the way, now it's not just I'll harden the heart of Pharaoh. I'll harden the heart of the Egyptians. I'm going to take the whole army out. And I will get me honor upon Pharaoh, as Rick just said, and upon all his host, and upon his chariots, and upon his horsemen. I'm going to take them all out to my honor. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten me honor upon Pharaoh, upon his chariots, and upon his horsemen. Now think about it again. Why is all this happening? Because God, yeah, he said to Abram, I'm going to do this stuff. These generations of Egyptians that just happened to be alive when this all happened, did they do anything directly where they were responsible for it? They were born into a time and a place where the Israelites just happened to be the slaves in Egypt. And they were born and they were raised up and they joined the army or were conscripted into the army. They're just there. Remember, this is the same God who supposedly loves everybody so much, wants everybody to be saved. God is not willing that any should perish. 2 Peter 3:9. Boy, did we hear that a lot in this sermon that we respond to. God's not willing that any should perish. Does he seem willing that people perish here?
Yes.
You know, well, then either 2 Peter 3:9 and this passage are in direct conflict, or maybe more likely their assumptions about what 2 Peter 3:9 means is inaccurate. But you have to listen to that to find out what the real answer is. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them, and I will get me honor upon Pharaoh and his host and his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten honor upon Pharaoh and his chariots and his horsemen. And the angel of God, the messenger of God, which went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them. This is that pillar of cloud and pillar of fire that was leading them. Now goes up behind them, and look at what it does. And the pillar of the cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. And it was a cloud and darkness to the Egyptians. But it gave light by night to Israel, so that the one did not come near the other all night. You got to think, if you're talking about roughly 1 million people that have to pass through a causeway through the Red Sea, it's going to take some time. So we got to slow the army down. Who shows up to slow the army down? The pillar of fire and the pillar of smoke. The very same emblems that made the deal to begin with, that made the promise and formed the covenant to bring those very same people to that very same land, shows up here. And on one side, it's a blessing. It's light in the night so that they can pass through to salvation. And on the other side, it is darkness to keep the Egyptian army at bay. Isn't that remarkable? This is a very sovereign God who's very much in control.
Kind of like the two-edged sword,
yes,
or what Paul speaks in Corinthians about the gospel being the aroma of life and the stench of death,
yeah,
at the same time.
The scent of life and the scent of death to some, life to life and death to death.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And so, verse 21, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. That, by the way, is part of the idea of the strong wind. The strong wind would dry that land underneath the sea so that they could walk on it. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. And you know, when I watch the Cecil B. DeMille movie, which is what we're all thinking right now, and they're walking through it, I often wondered, if you stopped in the middle of it, would you get to see fish? Would it be like one of those great aquariums where you're walking through the tube and you could see the fish? And because wouldn't the fish just come like right up to the edge there and go, well, I guess we can't go this way today. We could go this way earlier, but we can't go. There's people down here. Anyway, those are the kind of ideas that keep me up nights right there. They went through on dry ground. And then look, the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went in after them in the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen. And it came to pass that in the morning watch, the Lord took unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of the cloud and troubled the host of the Egyptians and took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them heavily, dragging them behind the horses, so that the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. Really, what was your first clue? I would have thought this was obvious for a long time. And the Lord said unto Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters will come again upon the Egyptians and the chariots and the horsemen. And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to his strength when the morning appeared, and the Egyptians fled against it. And the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them, then remained not so much as one of them. But the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on the right and the left. So what I wanted you to see here was the actual deliverance out of Egypt, which was part and parcel of what God promised Abram in response to the question, how will I know that I'm going to get this land? That same imagery that he fell asleep and had the dream of God passing through and making the covenant, that same imagery shows up to protect them, to judge Egypt, and to bring Israel out with a mighty hand. Everything God said he was going to do, he did by that same imagery. Now, you would think that any intelligent person at that point among the Israelites would go, clearly now, God is on our side. He's clearly for us here. And yet soon they're going to get right to the edge of the promised land, and they're going to send in a couple of spies to go see what the land looks like. And they come back and they say, oh, it's great. It's a land of milk and honey. But there are giants in the land. And we were like grasshoppers in our own eyes. In other words, if we go in there, the giants will wipe us out. We can't go in there. And because of that lack of faith, God causes them to wander 40 years in the wilderness, and everybody over 20, he strews their bones in the desert and in the wilderness so that only the children that he didn't kill, the children get to go into the promised land. But we'll get to all that typology too, because as you're going to see generation after generation as God deals with Israel, it's always that second generation. So it's that second one, the younger one, that gets the promise.
And that's the, you know, that's the very bad example of unbelief mentioned both in Corinthians and in Hebrews.
Brought up all the time, their lack of belief.
Not to follow.
Yes.
And so, you know, you have this.
Don't close that Bible. I'm not quite done.
You know, a lot of time going by here, and still, it's all about God.
Always about God. Always, always about God. I just want to finish this covenant then that God is forming. So I'm back in Genesis 15. Now that you know the story, now listen to the words here. Know of a surety that your seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, we now know that's Egypt, and shall serve them, we know that happened, and they shall afflict them for 400 years, we know all about that. And also, that nation whom they shall serve, I will judge. That's the Egyptians. And he did judge them to his own glory. And afterwards, they'll come out with great substance. We know that they came out with all the stuff they had borrowed from the Egyptians. And you will go to your fathers in peace, and you'll be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, after 400 years, they will come here again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. You would think, when they got there, they would go, well, this is it. We're here. This is exactly what God said would happen. Everything he said would happen happened, and here we are. This is it. Let's just walk in and take this land. This is clearly ours. It's a no. Faithless people. Did their faithlessness, again, keep God from delivering Israel into the promised land?
Nope.
No. Did their faithlessness keep God from using Israel as his battering ram against the Amorites and the Canaanites when he brought them in? No, God continues to do exactly what God said he would do because the faithfulness of God is the root of it all. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. In that same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given, past tense, this land. Now, he's just said to them, they're not even going to occupy the land for another good 500-600 years tops. But then know that I have, past tense, given it. And when you read what I'm about to read, I'll just tell you in very broad terms, we're not just talking about modern-day Israel now. We're talking about all the way into the land that we now know is Iraq and Iran and up into Turkey. The description is, I've given you this land from the river of Egypt. Think how far south now. You're talking about the Nile River. From the river in Egypt under the great river, the Euphrates. Where's the Euphrates run? Through modern Iraq. So the land we're talking about is a much larger piece of land than the modern-day state of Israel. The Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaim and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites. I'm going to give you all their land. Now, knowing that the ites are normally named after the name of their progenitor, I think the Kenites and the Kenizzites came from a guy named Ken. And that's just my opinion. So next week we will start at chapter 16. And we'll get into Abram taking this all in and saying, okay, I'm going to have descendants and I'm going to have this land. And he looks at his wife and goes, but apparently not with her. And she says, I got an idea. God's made us these promises. Why don't we work it out in our flesh? I'm glad you said that, not me, because I'd get hit. And so they go to work working it out in their flesh to try to keep the promises of God. And it's going to create a race of people who are a problem not only to the Israelites, but at this very moment, to the whole world, as a result of Abram deciding, well, I'll just go in the tent with a handmaid and see if we can't produce this offspring that God's been talking about. And then that idea gets picked up in the New Testament. And we're going to read in Galatians that Abram going into the tent with Hagar is a type of the law, a type of men saying, the promise of God is right there. I think I'll work it out in my flesh. Paul's going to use it to say, no, the promises of God come through the children of the free. The woman and the bondage, the law, none of that can get you actual salvation. But the children of the free are the children of promise, and that God keeps his promises to his children. So this is just great stuff that not only is great Old Testament history, but has all this wonderful New Covenant application. So we'll get into that next week. All right? So grab yourself a copy of that on the way out and enjoy.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.